All right, if you would please turn to Hebrews chapter 10. Now, I mentioned last Lord's Day that the instruction or exposition of Jesus Christ and his priesthood had ended. But if you were to read chapter 10, it seems that it's not ended at all. I think that we'll see that this chapter starts an exhortation or a hinge between doctrine and exhortation. It's an encouragement to readers, not so much an exposition. Throughout time, it seems, well, I guess you'd say there are a lot of people that think, well, from the cross on, that you need to do something for salvation. Most of the people that truly believe that you need to do something for salvation are miserable. For the more that they do, the more they seem to be further away from God or cannot at least seem to get any closer. The more that they do, the more they realize they're not getting closer, but what they actually see is that they're not getting closer, but they see how far apart they actually are from God. Martin Luther, as you know, used to put himself, you know, through the press, you know, sleeping on the cold ground, locking himself in his room, I mean, things, and what it was, he ended up getting miserable because of it. And he saw how much of a sinner he was. He knew that he was not getting in closer with God, and it's a time, as he put it, of spiritual despair. The one time whenever he was working hardest to please God was the time that he would say that he was in spiritual despair. And if you think about it, what a state to be in, where you realize your sin, you do things to help erase or better yourself, but deep down you know that it has done nothing. You're still in your miserable estate. You realize that you can't do something to bring you closer to God in your own body. Let's read our text today. Some may seem as though it's repeating itself, but we'll pick out some different aspects to focus on here. Let's begin in verse 1. For since the law has but a shadow of good things to come instead of a true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having been cleansed, would no longer have a consciousness of sins? But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, sacrifices and offerings, he said, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure." Then I said, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God, and it is written of me in the scroll of the book." When he said above, "You have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings, these are offered according to the law." Then he added, "Behold, I have come to do your will." He does away with the first in order to establish the second. And by that will, we've been sanctified through an offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But when Jesus had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. Amen. It seems he's repeating himself. He's repeating the same words, but he also brings a different thought, a deeper thought while doing so. Verse 1, for since the law has but a shadow of good things to come instead of the true form of these realities. Now, stop right there. He speaks of the law. The law. It's but a shadow of good things to come. Is the law over? Did it end with the old covenant? Chapter 7, in verse 19, it says, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced with which we draw near to God. It seems that the law is dead. The law couldn't get it done, so it seems that it's done away with. Paul in Galatians 3 says, is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not. For if the law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. Paul says in Romans chapter 10 and verse 4, Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Now, some take this as the moral law. that the moral law makes nothing perfect. The moral law has been done away with. But what law is he speaking of here? In chapter 7, we know that he's speaking of animal sacrifices. We've covered that, the ceremonial law. Which if we read Galatians slowly, we would see he's also speaking of the ceremonial law. And here in chapter 10, we read it is also animal sacrifices. It is the ceremonial law that he is speaking of. For we read in verse 1, "For since the law has but a shadow of good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities, it can never," here we go, "by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins." Verse 3, "But in these sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin." The law he speaks of is clear. It is not the moral law, but the Levitical system. The law which implements sacrifices. That is the law that he's speaking of. Now, we have, no pun intended, covered the Levitical system, so we will not spend much time here. But I want you to notice something here. Think about this. What is the Levitical system doing? What is it in place for? What's it there for? It's atonement. Dealing with sins. Having sins dealt with. He here says that they could not cleanse the conscience of sin, these sacrifices. And before he said the people knew it. The people knew that it didn't clear their conscience of sin. The people would sacrifice, but in verse 3 he says the sacrifices, the festivals, the Day of Atonement, were really just a reminder of their sins. They would every year be reminded, every day they could be reminded of sin, but never were they taken away. Their consciences knew it. It's the same thing with Luther. The more Luther did, the more it was a magnifier that he was a sinner. And it's true, the more that we try to appease God because of our sin, the more it's a reminder of our sin. Read Bunyan's Grace Abounding and you'll read the same problem. The writer says these sacrifices did nothing really and the people knew it. And you can say, Pastor, we've already covered that. Well, yes. But he wants to show you another reason the law of sacrificing animals was not adequate to cleanse from sin. But not only that, and this is the key, God didn't particularly like the work of the law when it was performed by the people. I mean, think about that. God set up the sacrifices, he set up the law, yet the sacrifices did nothing effectually, the people knew it, and the law which God set up did not please him when they did follow it. Look at verse 5. "Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, 'Sacrifices and offerings you've not desired, but a body you have prepared for me in burnt offerings and sin offerings, you have taken no pleasure.'" Have you thought about that? God set up the Levitical system, yet it says here, "Sacrifices and offerings you've not desired. In burnt offerings and sin offerings, you've taken no pleasure." Why? Why, if the people are doing all that he commanded, following his law, sacrificing only the perfect sacrifices, the most unblemished animals, everything to the letter of God's law, does God not take pleasure in it? If God makes up a system and the people follow it to the letter, let's say even the priests were good priests. Now, Malachi says they're up, but let's just say the priests were just the perfect priests. And they're doing everything, and the worshipers are coming, doing everything it is that they're supposed to do to offer sacrifices. Why would God take no pleasure with them? Now, think for a minute. Why are they sacrificing bulls and goats? It's because they've sinned. Because they've broken God's moral law, it's because they've broken God's moral law that they are required to follow God's Levitical law. He's not pleased when they follow the law of sacrifices, when they follow the law for sin offerings, because it means they've sinned. It means they've turned from God yet again. So no, offerings and sacrifices do not please him, for it means sin against him has taken place. He wants obedience. With obedience, there is no need for sin sacrifices, is there? Let's say that you have your son or your daughter, and they're constantly hitting their brother or sister, but I'm sure there's no brothers or sisters that are constantly hitting their siblings, but let's just say that that was a reality just for a moment. You go to them, and you set up a law. You say, "Can you do that? You must go to your room for 30 minutes. And another part of my law says you must go to your brother or sister and say that you're sorry." And they do that. Every day they comply. Every day they say they're sorry, and every day they go to their room for 30 minutes. Are you pleased with them? They're doing everything you have commanded. Right? You must be overjoyed that they are going to sit in that corner for 30 minutes following the letter of your law, and then they will go around and say that they're sorry. But no, you're not overjoyed. Because if they are saying sorry daily, it means they are trespassing daily. And you do not desire them to do that. You desire obedience. Your law is only there for when they're not obedient. You take no pleasure when they do your law, for it means they have sinned. So God demands that they do this for sin. But what is it that God ultimately demands? It's righteousness, right? Righteousness. God demands righteousness. He demands obedience, to which no one will see the Lord. Now, this section here is from Psalm 40. Let's read it in Psalm 40. Now, you may want to keep a finger on Hebrews 10 there, but God demands righteousness. Now, when he does not receive perfect obedience, perfect righteousness, what does he then demand, Mom and Dad? What would he then demand? Well, Mom and Dad wouldn't demand lifeblood. Some might. But he demands the lifeblood, death, animals in the place of their own blood. The writer to the Hebrews said that Christ said these words in Psalm 40 here. And look at Psalm 40 and verse 6. In sacrifice and offerings you have not delighted, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you have not required. Then I said, "Behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book is written of me. I delight to do your will, O God. Your law is within my heart. I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation." What is it that God demands ultimately? It's righteousness. It's obedience. It's to do his will. Simply put, it is righteousness. What did God demand of Adam in the garden? Obedience. Perfect righteousness, to do his will. He wanted Adam to do his will. Adam was required to do God's will, and he did not do so. And Romans 5:12 through 19 tells us, because he was our representative head, or our federal head, or our covenant head, whichever term you like, that all placed under him fell and were made unrighteous. Righteousness was not to be found from that point on anywhere on the earth. But you see there in verse 9, "I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation." Now look in your margin, or at the bottom of your page. Should have a little mark there. Does it say anything at all about the word deliverance? Mine says, literally, righteousness. "I have told the glad news of righteousness in the great congregation." And in verse 10, it uses the same word. "I've not hidden your righteousness within my heart," which fits very well with the rest of the psalm of doing God's will, does it not? Doing God's will is being righteous. It seems that Christ has, because he says that Christ is the one speaking this psalm, It seems Christ has good news about the subject of righteousness for the congregation, the very thing that all under Adam lack, the very thing that God ultimately demands. Did you notice anything else about verse 6 compared to what the writer of the Hebrews quoted? Hebrews says, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me." But in Psalm 40 it says, "Sacrifice and offerings you have not delighted in, but you have given me an open ear." Now what goes on here? The writer says the text says, "A body you've prepared for me." But we read Psalms 40 and it says, "You've given me an open ear." Now, in the Septuagint, that's the Greek Old Testament, you know, where they took the Hebrew, they translated it into Greek. It reads exactly like the Hebrews 10 passage. But here, the Hebrew Old Testament would be translated, "You've given me an open ear." Or in your margins, again, you can look down in your margin and it says, "And ears you have dug for me," would be a literal reading. If we say, "God dug out my ears," what are we saying in one sense? Yes, he's formed me. I guess you could say, prepared a body for me. Okay, back to Hebrews 10. Now, the writer has said that this was indeed Christ speaking, saying he came to do the Father's will. That sacrifices and burnt offering was not what pleased God. No, he's right. They were there because righteousness and his will wasn't followed. Christ said as much in a few places in the Gospels. In John 6, he says, "I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Now let me ask again, what is it that God demands above all else? This is the key to your salvation. It's righteousness, to do his will. What happens when one does not do his will? What does God demand? Right, it's payment, lifeblood. God demands righteousness, obedience. He demands we all do his will. Adam, as I said, did not do his will, and we all sinned that day. Since that day in the garden, and of course with the entire Levitical system, animal sacrifices were instituted, and we covered that they were only flesh deep. The unblemished animal was only that, unblemished on the flesh. You see, the animal could not do what? The animal could not do the one thing that God demanded first and foremost for you to do. The animal could never do the will of God. The animal was only in place to cover the sin of not doing his will, to avert wrath, to set aside the death that was required because of sin. The animal, the bull, the goat, the lamb, the sparrow, could only handle the thing that happened after sin occurred. The animal could never do righteousness, the very thing that God did desire. The animal could not perform God's will. Now, that's why sacrifices could only be a reminder of sin. That's why they were instituted. Even with sacrifices, the key thing that God demanded and desired was righteousness. And that there is never a substitute for. The first Adam did not do God's will, and all placed under him died that day. Whatever it was that he did was attributed to those that were placed under him. Now then, so here's the question. Where will man find righteousness? A substitute death was ordained that covered for sin, but how does that man have righteousness attributed to him? All men sin, none are righteous, none do good, none seek, Romans 3. How could man obtain righteousness that God demanded whenever we all fell that day in the garden? Another would have to come that could perform his will, but it could not be a bull or a goat, because they're not born of a woman under the law. They could not represent the obedience part. They could not fulfill the moral law in order to be representative for man. Even if they could be a covering for sin, even if they could really take the sting of death away, they could not be righteous. They've not followed God's moral law. They've never been tempted. They could not have had bad English. They could not have had no other. They could not have had no other gods. They could not honor the Sabbath. They could not bear false witness. They could not worship God. They could only be a skin-deep representative for sin committed. Now, God demands righteousness, and if no righteousness is found, death occurs. Having a sacrifice for the unrighteous act still does not make one righteous. It only covers unrighteousness. So what man needs is one that is righteous to perform and fulfill what God had initially commanded, and man will need one that will pay the penalty for the sins committed, for the unrighteous. The key is an animal will never be able to fulfill the law. It will have to be man. Yet, we read, all sin, none are righteous, there's no one that does good. No, one is going to have to come somehow. Somehow one will have to appear that was not born under the first Adam. But how could one not be a child of Adam? Look at verse 5. Consequently, when Christ came into the world. Stop there. Remember names and how the author uses them throughout this book? He says, Christ came, which means the Messiah, the Christos came. The sent one came. The anointed one of God came into the world. The Messiah or the sent one. One sent from someplace else. The Messiah is sent. We know that he is sent from heaven. He is God's. The sent Messiah says in verse 5, sacrifice and offerings you've not desired. He's right, because that would mean unrighteousness. The exact opposite of righteousness has taken place. And then this Christ, this sent one from God, says, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you've taken no pleasure. Now, look there. The Messiah has been sent. God has come down. But how can God represent man? He's God. But it says here, God prepares a body for him. Is it an animal body? Is it a goat body? Is it a bull body? No, it's the body of man. The Messiah would come down from heaven, and a human body would be prepared for him. But for what purpose? Just to wash away sin? Just to cover sin? No. Verse 7, then I said, behold, I have come to do your will. The Messiah is sent from heaven. He is God. We know that from other texts. And a body has been prepared for him. For what purpose? To do God's will. To fulfill the moral law. The thing that God always required of man. Now watch this name change here. Verse 8. When he said above, you've neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings, these are offered according to the law. Then he added, behold, I have come to do your will. He does away with the first in order to establish the second. And by that will, we've been sanctified through the offering of the, look at the name change, the body of Jesus Christ once for all. See, Christ came. The Messiah was sent, God is sent, he's given a human body to do the law of God, to perform righteousness, to do his will. Doing his will, performing righteousness, of everything that God's demanded, he also pays the penalty. And then look what's emphasized here. Through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ, the Messiah was sent, the body's prepared. That body, the result of God coming down, taking on flesh, it's produces what is known as the God-man called Jesus Christ. You see, his humanity and his deity is present. Notice, it's Christ, he says, that was sent. And the name now is no longer Christ, through the offering of Christ, through the offering of Jesus Christ. The body, that is the human body of Jesus, not just the Messiah, not just God, but the man Jesus Christ, the God-man. The animals could never do the will of God. God sends one down from heaven. The Messiah, he takes on flesh. He is now the representative for all that God has given him. John 17. He fulfills the law as man, something that bulls and goats could never do. He offers himself for the penalty of sin. The writer gives us a glimpse into the doctrine of Christ's two natures. A man would have to come and do his will. A man would have to die for the sins. A man could not be found on earth, for all sinned. So he sends his son and he prepares a body for him. Now listen to Athanasius. I know that we covered him quite a bit in church history. He fought for the deity of Christ. One of the reasons he was exiled 5 times was because he fought for the deity of Christ. He was fighting for the God-man. Here's what Athanasius says here about this text. He says, "This is the reason why he assumed a body capable of dying, so that belonging to the Word," that's who is above all, he's talking about God, "in dying he might become a sufficient exchange for all." Basically what he's saying is, man needed to represent man, so God takes on flesh, he says. And as God, that's where he's saying, the Word himself was a sufficient exchange for all. But he needed to be man. He needed to be God. He needed to be man. Athanasius goes on. "When he offered his own temple and bodily instrument as a substitute for life, of all he fulfilled in death, all that was required." So, see, he offers his bodily instrument as a substitute for life, and then his death for all that's required, of course, because of the unright. His body is for righteousness. His death is going to be for unrighteousness. He says the second Adam, basically, is doing the will of God. He acts for his people. He's a true substitute on the cross. He fulfilled what was required in life, that is obedience, and he fulfilled what was required of us in death. Listen to a little bit more of Athanasius. "He put on a body, so that in the body he may blot out death. He was not limited and confined by the body. Indeed, the wonderful thing is that at one and the same time as man, he was a living human life, as the Word was sustaining life in the universe." You know, like in Hebrews, he upholds all things with his hands. "And as Son, he was in constant union with the Father." Now, I know it's hard to read some of the apostolic fathers or even to pick them up midway through like we did here, but needless to say, he gets it. He sees also this two natures of Christ being explored here. With the first Adam, or with us, God demands righteousness. No one after the garden is found righteous. No one on earth can act and do what God has required. You, me, Luther, anyone else. So God sends his son. But of course, God's God. He cannot act for man. So he takes on flesh and becomes the God-man. Jesus Christ. With the body that God has prepared for him. He does something no one could do. Especially goats or bulls. He does God's will. He performs the law. He fulfills all of God's law. He's done so for the people placed under him. That is what pleases God. That is what he wants. He does not want sorries for sinning. He wants obedience. And Jesus performs that will for those given him. But those given him still owe God for sins committed. And he does what only he could do. The man Jesus prays for the sins of the men under him. An animal cannot do that. There's no equal for man but man. This is why the doctrine of Jesus having two natures is so important. If he was not human, he could not be our true representative. In what way does he represent us? Well, what's needed? What was needed with the first Adam? Righteousness. But because we've all sinned, now it's not just righteousness that is needed. That was only in the garden. What is needed now to stand before God is an atonement for sin. Righteousness plus the atonement for sin, the payment for sin. The only payment for sin performed by man is death. There's no work. There's no money. There's no anything but death. Now, let me read you this. This is from Leviticus 17, speaking of the atonement. Leviticus 17:11. "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it for you on the altar." What's the purpose? "To make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by the life." You see, so the atonement is dealing with sin. It's dealing with the unrighteous part. The death is going to deal with that. Now, many preach Jesus as the payment for sins, and rightfully so. They preach that he pays the penalty for sins committed, that it pays for unrighteousness. But the key is, never forget, we would still be lacking righteousness. Turn to Colossians 1, please, and we'll close up with Colossians 1, I think. God requires that all men be righteous. All men do His will while they are in the flesh. It is not just Jesus Christ's death and blood that we rest on and trust upon, for that only takes care of the penalty for not doing what God first commanded. And God, we read, is not pleased with us paying penalties. He is instead pleased with righteousness. Now here's a well-known passage of Jesus being fully God and fully man. I know that you're familiar with it. Colossians 1 verse 19, "For in Him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell." There we have, He's fully God. Verse 20, "And through Him to reconcile to Himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of His cross." So He's making peace with God by His death. He acted for a certain group, not just for Himself, as Paul writes. "And you, who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds." Remember, no one was righteous, no one seeks, no one, okay. And that's because that first sin in the garden, we all lost righteousness, we were alienated. "He has now reconciled," remember He said before, He's fully God, "in His body of flesh by His death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before Him." So in His body of flesh, His human body, His manhood, He reconciled you by His death. Now look what it says here. "Presents you holy and blameless." Now have you ever thought about that? How? Well, in the flesh He did what according to Hebrews? He did the will of God. He fulfilled the law. He represented us in that way, as well as making peace with His blood. Without Him doing God's will, without Him fulfilling the law in His flesh, we could not be holy or above reproach. We need to be holy and blameless, brethren. That means we need righteousness, something that we can never get from a bull or a goat, something we can never obtain by sleeping on cold floors or depriving ourselves. It's something that we lost with our first representative head, Adam. The more we try to do, the more we deprive ourselves, the more we try to pay for our sins, the more we're reminded of them. Because deep down we know it is righteousness and only righteousness that pleases God. Paying for sin is not what He desires. Now we see why animals could never be a substitute for man. They could never do the will of God. We see the need for Christ to be sent from heaven and the need that He have a body prepared for Him to be a man. We see it's not just a payment for sins, but a lack of righteousness, which is our first ailment. And so God sent Christ, prepared a body for Him, the man Jesus, to do what no man since the garden or animal on earth could do, to do what God first demanded, and that is simply His will. The Levitical system could never give what God demanded, that's righteousness, because that is found in only doing His will. He is our righteousness, as the Scriptures tell us, and it's only Him. There is no other way, whether by animals working, depriving ourselves, whatever it is, any other thing you can think of, to be presented holy and blameless before Him. Think about this. Holy is what? Holy is going to be righteous. What is blameless? There's no black mark on us. So one is righteousness. The blameless is having our sins paid for it. Okay? Christ being sent into the world to do His will. Holy, set apart. Set apart to do His will. Okay? Blameless. There's no charge against us. There's no blame that can be attached to us. Holy is the positive. Blameless is the negative. By His righteousness we're made holy. By His death, paying for our penalty, we are made blameless. We rest and trust upon the righteousness in His death. Let's pray.